morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Of course, you know that yesterday, September 11th, was the 18th annual Worst Day in America commemoration, known universally as 9/11, which are also the call numbers for emergency. 9/11/2001 is considered the bloodiest day in American history and is compared to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, as also a day of infamy. None of the grotesque tragedy in New York City and Washington, D.C. was reflected here in the Pacific Northwest that day. It was a beautiful late summer day, clear and blue at the mouth of the Columbia River. That night, the Big Dipper rolled around the sky like a puppy outside my window in Astoria. Much of today's program is about 9/11. So I give the same disclaimer I gave on my program 18 years ago, 2 days after 9/11. The following is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire universe. It is an attempt to provide a personal context to the occurrences of Tuesday, September 11th, and is not especially cohesive and possibly not entirely coherent. And I should preface that an experience of war might harden a person, but also makes that person much more sensitive to horror and tragedy. The difference is that despite shock and surprise at a particular catastrophe, horror is never unexpected. An obscure point of history. On September 11, 1966, the Viet Cong assassinated South Vietnamese government members and conducted raids on American and South Vietnamese installations, as well as attacks on villages, to confound elections for a so-called constitutional convention. I was a witness. And not as obscurely, September 11, 1973 was the date when the American CIA engineered the overthrow and subsequent death of Chile's elected president, Salvador Allende, which was the major subject of this program last week, September 5, 2019. Forever 9/11. And this is something I wrote with a prologue. Once upon a time in a fairy tale past, the United States of America thought it was safe from the strifes of the world. Isolated by oceans, its populace fatuously believed it would protect them, even after half a century of a nuclear arms race and development of supersonic missiles, the USA assumed a Buck Rogers space shield would save it from harm. And from its inviolate fortress, the USA exported a highly sophisticated form of terror, attacking countries all over the world for one purpose or another, generally from the air with bombs and missiles, and increasingly robot drones and smart bombs. The USA pioneered many of the methods of war from the air and stratosphere, and used bombs more than any other nation, especially on cities and small villages of other nations. The morning of September 11, 2001, dramatically ended the USA's illusory immunity. The Star-Spangled Banner was finally attacked in its homeland by suicidal commandos who made guided missiles of American jet airliners in a diabolically brilliant scheme of calculated devastation aimed at the cosmic cathedrals of American civilization and its manifest ambitions for global supremacy. The abiding memory of 9/11 would presumably be the human bodies falling from the smoky sky and crashing onto New York City streets, which was reminiscent of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire of 1911, when girls and young women jumped to their deaths to escape a burning fire trap sweatshop, also in New York City. About 3,000 persons died on 9/11. 146 in 1911, mostly women. And a continuing national angst on 9/11 anniversaries, at least, is probably a collectively personal nightmare of a jet airplane loaded with helpless captives aimed at all our windows. Other images recall 9/11. thousands of hands reaching up as though to stop the collapsing twin towers of the World Trade Center as they pancaked to the ground. News film of doomed firemen and policemen going up into the burning towers, passing survivors coming down towards safety. A woman on 9/11 morning said she saw crowds of people walking away from Ground Zero, stunned by the collapse of the towers. "Where are you going?" she asked. "Away," they said. An image that did not occur on 9/11, but has been falsely impressed on the mass mindset, is Donald Trump's persistent fabrication that thousands of Muslims in Jersey City across the river cheered the destruction of the World Trade Center. Also fake news is Trump's claim to the very people who spent months clearing away the contaminated rubble at Ground Zero that he had been among them, though he is obviously insensitive to their need for medical care resulting from extensive exposure to the piles, toxic stew of deadly chemicals, which is affecting many thousands of workers and volunteers nearly two decades later. Trump, who very well might be a cumulatively comparable disaster to 9/11, said in virtual penile scorn that collapse of the WTC towers made his Trump Tower the tallest skyscraper in New York City. But 9/11 was a disaster for George W. Bush, who was in Florida reading fairy tales to school children when the suicide bombers crashed into the WTC, the Pentagon, and a Pennsylvania field, which begat the specious sophistry of the so-called Bush Doctrine. Simply put, everything must be done to protect the USA from the rest of the world, while simultaneously ensuring every other place on Earth would be vulnerable to the power and retribution of the USA, which not only kept terrorist paranoia at high fever, but led directly to the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Rather than secularize and treat terrorists as international criminals to be captured and tried before the world court, the Bush Doctrine raised 9/11 to an apocalyptic struggle between good and evil, which, if not entirely a take-no-prisoners manifesto, allowed the torture of prisoners, contrary to humane principles of universal law. A grievous crime was committed against the United States on 9/11. But not one that was undeserved or should have been as unexpected. Americans have lived a long time in a false bubble that has assumed what harm the U.S. did elsewhere in the world would not in similar measure reach back to it. The attitude might be summed as, "It doesn't matter what we have done to you, only what you have done to us." Rather than seek international justice for a criminal act, the American response has been to make war and murder many more innocents without trial, and certainly without justice as died on 9/11, since 9/11. 9/11 unleashed instead a frenzy of bellicose patriotism in the USA. Prejudice, always waiting with its intolerant leer, leaped into the national dialogue, as it so often has, and continues unabated nearly two decades after 9/11, with discriminatory bans against Muslims and Middle Easterners in general, and everyone non-white and non-purified evangelist Christian in particular. Terms that quickly became prevalent in the U.S. to describe divergent types of humanity in Arab lands were ragheads and desert niggers, which continue in usage. Intense propaganda blitzes erase the ambiguities of everyday life to present contrast devoid of shades. Extreme subsumed dialogue, good versus evil, Christian America versus Allah and the thieves of Baghdad. "You're either with us or against us," George W. Bush declared unilaterally to the rest of the world. From the beginning, his stance was that cowardly terrorists, quote-unquote, who were opposed to our democratic way of life, were fanatically determined to destroy the USA, and that loyal Americans must preempt their evil ways by hunting down and destroying Islamic terrorists everywhere in the world. Although most Americans regarded whoever attacked the home country on 9/11 as cowardly terrorists, the terrorists most likely thought themselves as heroic Davids, standing up against the gigantic juggernaut of Goliath to revenge contemporary and historical grievances. They did not commit the atrocity of 9/11 because they were evil, but because they thought evil had been done to them, and they reciprocated as they were capable. They struck not only at the centers of American economic and military power, they were also, They struck not only at the centers of American economic and military power, they were also striking at American ambitions to be the heart of Western-dominated world civilization. The terrorists responded to perceived evil done to them by calling the USA the Great Satan. So we have two warring sides who claim God and right on their side. One with an arsenal capable of atomizing the world to oblivion, the other armed with comparatively inferior weapons, yet with imaginatively destructive intentions of their use. This so-called war of civilizations is the root problem that prevents a truly world civilization that has been a long-held dream, at least for dreamers, philosophers, poets, pacifists, and humanitarians weary of the interminable wars between tribes, cultures, religions, and nations. Here is the seemingly irresolvable problem that threatens humanity with possible annihilation. Here the best and worst traits of humanity are evident on both sides and clash head-on. Human civilization is on the brink of something cataclysmically dire and awesome. It stares into a vortex where separate ethos or ideologies rip their insides out. Armageddon, the final conflict, is invoked. It would be a grotesque irony that humanity, hopelessly mired in the irredeemable past, perishes because it is unable to resolve conflicts from its earliest history. War and peace are not abstracts. They are as personal as coitus and death. The way to kill evil is not by murdering women, men, and children. The world has been a bloody slaughterhouse throughout history. Any cry for more killing goes back to our past of fang and claw. Realizing this is the place for the future to intersect with this new millennium. Otherwise, we leave a legacy of waste, wretchedness, and ruin. We are a global civilization, like it or not. Nuclear weapons rendered the nation state as dead as dinosaurs. Climate change is a global catastrophe that only a global effort can even hope to alleviate if humanity intends to survive on this planet. And if the so-called global economy is meant to benefit only a few wealthy nations and mega corporations, rather than be a world structure meant to include everybody in equal protections and freedoms, then the residual nightmare of 9/11 is only an advent of a much darker and likely shorter future. And as a postscript, the annual 9/11 tribute lights that commemorate those who died that day are apparently endangering some 160,000 birds that fly over Lower Manhattan Island. The 9/11 anniversary coincides with the autumn bird migration over Manhattan, which puts diminishing bird populations at greater risk, already threatened by light pollution in New York City, collisions with buildings, habitat destruction, and climate change. And I will finish this with something called the World Peace Prayer. Lead me from death to life, from falsehood to truth. Lead me from despair to hope, from fear to trust. Lead me from hate to love, from war to peace. Let peace fill our heart, our world, our universe. I have no idea who wrote that. I just noticed it in an old issue of the North Coast Times Eagle when I was looking through it, and so I thought it would be pertinent for today. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. Fatigued by Trump Nation. On May 6, 1937, the German passenger airship Hindenburg crashed into Manchester Township, New Jersey. The horrific event was described by radio journalist Herbert Morrison, who uttered the legendary line, "Oh, the humanity." Yet of the 97 passengers on board, 62 survived. Bear that in mind as I describe the anguish that I and millions of Americans have suffered during the nearly three-year tenure of Donald Trump. For those hypothetically awakening from a coma experienced on January 20th, 2017, I offer this summary of what author Timothy O'Brien deemed Trump Nation and offer some coping strategy suggestions. During the Trump presidency, thousands of immigrants have suffered arrest, detention, and horrific cruel treatment at our borders. Scores of Trump cohorts have resigned or been dismissed, too many for MSNBC's Rachel Maddow to continue listing on her wall of shame. Fraud and corruption forced legions of Trump's crime family, including several cabinet members, to resign. Especially notorious is Trump's hand-picked Attorney General William Barr, who blocked investigations of Trump's collusion with Russians and numerous instances of obstruction of justice. Trump's supporter and principal obstructor, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, refuses to entertain House-passed legislation to preserve health care programs, create green jobs, protect the environment, nor allow votes on gun control legislation passed by the House. I'm talking about incompetency, greed, racism, and mean-spiritedness run amok. Recent scandals, as of July 2019, include the White House tormenting and shaming of veteran British Ambassador Kim Darroch, forcing him to resign on July 10th. Darroch correctly described Trump as inept, a president who radiates insecurity, quote unquote. Trump's Secretary of Labor, Alex Acosta, was forced to resign after allegations that he provided a notorious sweetheart deal to protect billionaire sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein from the lengthy prison term he richly deserved. I can't forget Trump's hijacking of the 2019 Fourth of July celebration, offering a hollow, self-serving salute to America on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, the same steps where Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech before 250,000 on August 28, 1963. The extremely stable genius, quote unquote, and presidential prevaricator extraordinaire drew one audience estimate of just 10,000. I simply couldn't set store by that egomaniac saluting himself, since that would have summoned the sensation of settling slowly to the bottom of the ocean. Add to that litany Trump's idiosyncratic use of language in his tweets and speeches, his constant claims of fake news, and the 10,000-plus lies counted by the Washington Post and other agencies, and, well, you get the picture. If you have any doubts about Trump's mental state, I highly recommend you read psychiatrist Justin Frank's 2018 book, Trump on the Couch. Bear in mind that I provided only a partial list of Trump's shortcomings, including impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors. So, how can I and millions of fellow sufferers, sometimes approaching the threshold of pain, cope with the remainder of our prevaricator-in-chief's tenure? Anger management courses may or may not help, since we really need to focus our anger to seek retribution. I could write more satirical essays and letters, though that would only provide temporary relief. I'll certainly participate in protests, marches, and other gatherings to reduce some stress. I could try to avoid watching TV or at least reduce viewing time, but that would reduce my awareness of Trump and his crime family misgivings, and I need to stay on top of that. An anger management course wouldn't help much, since I really need to focus my anger, so I seek retribution. Liquor and drugs wouldn't help much either, and I'm not convinced that I can meditate my way out of my threshold of pain. I'll definitely continue to hang out with like-minded progressives, enjoy occasional beach walks, pamper my pooches, and watch amusing films by Mel Brooks, Monty Python, and the Marx Brothers. That might help a bit. The serenely perfect compositions of Mozart would temporarily assuage me. And Eric Idle's tongue-in-cheek ditty from The Life of Brian, "Always look on the bright side of life," could provide some comic relief. I haven't quite reached the tipping point, but I do hold out some hope for redemption, harboring the prospect of Trump's 2020 defeat, the ousting of Mitch McConnell, and the gigantic task of undoing significant damage to our people and planet. Remember, 2/3 of the Hindenburg passengers survived the crash. And that was by Dr. Robert Brake, who is a retired college prof and lives in Ocean Park, Washington. And now, from the Washington Post, by Alexandra Petrie, on giving up. Well, it has been decided, after Odessa, if not after Sandy Hook, or Las Vegas, or Parkland, things cannot continue like this. To keep going, we will have to give up certain things. We will have to give up, first of all, the feeling that we are safe anywhere, at prayer, at work, at school, on the way home. We are lucky if we ever had this feeling to give up. We will have to give up the notion that there is anywhere this could not happen, that there is a single place, a concert, a highway, a shopping center, where we should not be afraid. We must give up the old meanings of the names of places. Towns and cities across the country must wait to become synonymous with the worst thing that anyone has ever done there. These are just a few of the things we must give up. We must give up expecting anything else. We will have to give up, for instance, the idea that a school is not a fortress. Schools will be redesigned against invasions, like medieval castles or World War I trenches, complete with oil, curved walls, and zigzags to interfere with sight lines. We must give up the quaint notion that public spaces should be designed from any perspective but one of abject terror. There will be random drills, random searches. Backpacks will be reinforced, usefully or not, with bulletproof materials. We will transform all soft targets, a sorrowful euphemism for the places in civilization that are most precious, into hard targets. There will be guards and metal detectors. Teachers will carry guns. Libraries will be heavily armed. We must give up these tender places civilization has made. We will have to live in bunkers protected by metal detectors and gates. And we must give up something else, even more precious than a place or a way of being. We will give up people. We will give up a father of two, a young man excited to start his own family, a 15-year-old girl still in the middle of discovering who she was going to be. We will give up getting to hear the end of her story. We will give up all the things they would have done, things that might have been huge and noteworthy, but could have been simple and ordinary, which would have been just as remarkable. We will have to give up the feeling that the preference of the majority count for anything with our elected representatives, if we were still holding on to that feeling. We will have to give up the idea that this could change if we wanted to, or there is something else we could give up. It might not feel so much like giving up as this does. And that was On Giving Up by Alexandra Petrie. And she wrote that for the Washington Post. And now, my brief moment to join the beggar's chorus for money for KMUN these final days of its 36th annual Autumn Pledge Drive that winds up on Saturday, September 14th, which, as a matter of note, is the 140th birthday of the legendary Margaret Sanger, founder of the American Birth Control League, which later became Planned Parenthood. KMUN has given me great pleasure ever since its opening hurrah by Liam Dunn on April 17, 1983. I am partial to public media and especially the concept of listener-sponsored community radio. KMUN depends upon revenues provided by listeners and functions as a nonprofit entity. The carnivorous coupon clipping culture of Greater Yankee Doodle Incorporated undervalues any sort of endeavor that does not seek or encourage profit. The bottom line of American life is the bottom line. Even the most pleasant, sensitive, and fragile pleasures are forced onto the money market and upscaled to such an impossible reach that only a few are able to afford their cash-contaminated bliss. It is a shame and a disgrace that the major worship of our society is wealth, which disregards other values that, in essence, are intrinsically priceless. Alternate voices among the noisy clamor for purchasing power seem lost on the floor of the national stock market. KMUN reflects a few of those voices. A small freestyle radio station at the bottom of the FM dial in a far-off upper-left corner of Caveat Emptor. But it is here, despite spurious claims by corporate mediocrity, that it alone represents democracy and the First Amendment. A micromedia, free, spirited radio station such as KMUN depends upon true democracy to broadcast. And so it does because ordinary citizens keep it alive with their personal participation in time and tithe, an incomparable mix of active community citizenship. That is what community radio is all about, a collective voice of many variations that not only strives to reflect a community, but also to inform it, to present, discuss, and argue ideas, thoughts, and opinions commercial radio abhors as controversial and unprofitable, to be shunned as though they were dialectic diseases. KMUN's first director, Harriet Baskus, said from the very beginning, KMUN, as a community radio station in the Pacific Northwest, shares with community stations worldwide the themes of democratization of communication, of as wide a community participation as possible, and of creating an accessible forum for the exchange of cultural and political ideas. And that was Harriet Baskus. Think universally, act locally. A majority begins with one. What a person does, reads, listens to, and thinks about form the character and ideas necessary not only for a personally gratifying life, but also assists alleviating sorrow or oppression of other lives. Harriet also said the KMUN community, like every other, would have its share of births and deaths, which in 36 years it has quite a few of each. Many KMUN voices are gone, and you can be assured you will have heard their ethereal whispers this past week, exhorting us to pledge to KMUN. You might remember them and the vital history they made for our KMUN radio station these past 3.5 decades. And you might also consider a suggestion past KMUN program director Joseph Stevenson made a few years back. The next time you see an old FM radio going for $3 at a garage sale, think what that and a gift membership might mean to a lonely senior citizen or a hard-pressed family. One listener echoed that sense of value. KMUN is a gift, a jewel, a miracle. And in closing, 120 years ago tomorrow, on September 13, 1899, the first automobile fatality in the United States occurred when a New York City motorist ran over a pedestrian at a corner of Park West and 74th Street. Although tomorrow is Friday the 13th this year, that unlucky accident happened on a Wednesday. This is Michael McCusker. Help make this Friday the 13th a very lucky day for KMUN by pledging. Pledge, pledge.